Let's say the auto industry was structured like our public schools, which means it'd be based on where you live. So just like school districts, there'd be lines on a map. One car district would be assigned BMWs, another district Nissans. Some get Fords, some get Hyundais, and a final district, they get Yugos. Note for younger viewers, this was a bad car. Of course, those stuck with the bad cars would complain, just like those stuck with bad schools. And you can imagine the response. Don't abandon the public car system. Try to work with the Yugo factory to improve it. But we've tried for years, they'd say. Can't we just get one of those other cars? No, the powerful public car workers union would answer. That would drain resources from the Yugo factory instead of improving it. Of course, with cars, the Yugo company went out of business. But bad schools never do. And whether it's cars, discount stores, drug stores, or coffee shops, it's just obvious that consumer power to choose is healthy, even in education, where at the college level, state and private schools compete just fine. And no, there's nothing magically different about the age of the student. Competition just makes things better.
Hey everybody, this is Brett, and welcome back to School Sex Podcast. Today is, I don't know, December 1st, 2011, so Merry Christmas, huh? It's right around the corner. Holiday cheer and all that. Hey, did you know that there is actually a Christmas song, an old Christmas song, a Christmas classic. People sing it in carols when they go caroling. You've probably sung it as a caroler yourself, if you caroled. You'll hear it playing in Walmart when you go to buy wrapping paper. You'll hear it on the radio. You'll certainly hear it at your holiday gatherings. Classic Christmas song. I think it was written in the 50s or the 60s. That has the F word in it. F word. F-U-C-K-I-N-G. I think we all know what that spells. Now, the story goes that the woman who recorded this song, I don't have any of those details at this point, when it was recorded or who that person was, but I do know that she was dared to slip in the F word, in the place of another word that the F word could be mistaken for because of the context. This was the 50s or 60s, but they had dares back then, and she did it. And to this day, nobody talks about this, but to this day, there is a Christmas song that has the F word in it. Now, if I tell you that the word that you're supposed to hear is pumpkin, are you starting to know what I'm talking about? Are you starting to say, wait a minute, I think I've heard the F word in a Christmas song too, but I never wanted to say anything to anybody because that's crazy. That's the F word. I started telling people years ago, nobody believed me, but then as soon as I could grab a version of the song and play it for them, they said, wow, Brett, that song says the F word in it. Send me a message on the Facebook page for School Sucks if you know the song I'm talking about. I bet you do. I bet this has occurred to some of you before. That, man, I think I just heard the F word in a Christmas song. So listen to me. I completely forgot how to record a podcast. This is a show about education, and that's what we're going to talk about today. This is something new that I'm trying, a kind of an ongoing series. I'll put one of these shows together whenever the mood strikes. The mood struck me recently because I saw a movie on the at home that I wanted to talk about on the show. You know, there's a lot of movies that deal with school, childhood, both feature and documentary, and I've been trying to watch some more movies lately. I used to be a real film buff. I used to be real into movies, and I have gotten more into television lately, and I'm trying to get back into some movies. So I've seen some good ones lately. I saw The Social Network, and I thought that was terrific. David Fincher directs that. He directed Fight Club. The cast is great. The soundtrack, the score was actually done by Trent Reznor. And I thought that movie just came together really well. I really enjoyed it. I saw the Coen Brothers movie, No Country for Old Men. Terrific. Really good sound in that movie. Really sound editing. That's important sound. Speaking of that, I've actually been working to improve the sound of this show considerably. This is like the first episode that I think I've really got it where I want it to be, or the best I can have it considering the equipment and the resources that I have at my disposal. I've been experimenting with a few different things, setups, using a compressor, and I really like that show that we did in the Free Talk Live studio. I really like the way that sounded, and I do have some motives for making the show sound considerably better than it's sounded in the past. We're going to be doing some new things, and I need the sound to be really optimal for that. I do have some people who are willing to help me. I want to say thanks to Kirk, who I'm still on my list to correspond with him, but sent me a very nice email. Kirk is the gentleman who does the sound and lighting at Porkfest. We talked and got to know each other a little bit at Porkfest last summer, and he sent me an email about seeing if he could help me out with sound a little bit. Now, he hasn't done anything yet. I wanted to get it as respectable as possible, and then I'll probably at least correspond with him about what could be done to make it better. But I just wanted to say thanks to Kurt for doing that. I really appreciate it. Now, yeah, so I saw movies. They're good. And I've got kind of a list of movies that I've always wanted to talk about on the show, but never really found a way to fit them in. So maybe over the course of the next, you know, little while, we can do some of these School Sucks at the Movie shows. The first one is a film called The Cartel, and it looks at what we'll call the education racket in the state of New Jersey, and it kind of expands it out to the entire nation. I think racket is a much more fitting word than public service. A guy made the movie's name is Bob Bowden. I did send an interview request to him. He never got back to me, so maybe I could have him on sometime in the future. But his story is he was a television reporter in New Jersey. He covered a variety of social, political, news type issues. And one thing that kept coming up was this, the educational system, the NJEA, and how they have their filthy little fingers all over the political dealings in the state of New Jersey. So he started doing more research, and that research ultimately led to this film. Nothing really mind-blowing. I think if you've been listening to this show and educating yourself on these types of issues, I don't think The Cartel will really contain many surprises. But I liked it because it uses for most of the film the state of New Jersey, which is particularly bad, as a case study for the corrupt nature of the government education system. And it's got numbers, if you like numbers, statistics and all that. It's got interviews. It goes to the union president, the NJEA president. We talked about the NJEA on the Teachers Union series. This woman is unbelievable. But Bowden looks at the corruption from a variety of different angles. Of course, the NJEA, the State Department of Education, the school boards, even right down to the administrative level of the schools themselves. And he even looks at all of the sort of the contractors, the people who sort of swing from the nipples of the state with getting these contracts through friends or connections, and then maybe building something, but maybe not building something. Millions of dollars disappear here, millions disappear there. You know, that kind of a thing. I mean, things we're certainly familiar with on a national level. For me, though, the reason why I wanted to talk about the film, even if I don't wind up talking about the actual film too much, is it really, I'm surprised, and I don't want to say I'm doing a 180, but it really got me thinking about one issue that I've been pretty consistent and pretty firm on since beginning this show over 2 years ago, and that's vouchers, school vouchers, which I always said from the research that I had done. And of course, this still might be true in other places, but it certainly didn't seem to be true in New Jersey, that the educational establishment, you know, the politicians and the unions would love a voucher system because it would be the Trojan horse that would allow them over time to seize control of more and more of the private institutions in education. You know, and charter schools are a part of this as well. People probably want to use the vouchers, if they could, for schools that are, you know, better student-teacher ratios, smaller, more innovative, you know, even if they don't have as much funding. I mean, apparently funding means nothing. I mean, I think we know that, that if a district, some of the worst school districts in New Jersey were spending like $18,000 or $19,000 per pupil, when less than 50%, in some cases like 25 or 30% of those pupils wound up graduating. And I think most of that pay is going to administrators or contracts, you know, and the teachers, pensions, of course. I mean, there's so many different things that so many different places the money has to go, besides to educating the students. And, of course, we have a very distorted sense of what it actually costs per year to educate a child, because so many children in this country are educated in this wasteful, corrupt public school system. So it turns out that the unions are, at least in their rhetoric, they're not crazy about these vouchers. They are terrified of vouchers and charter schools. And in the film, Bowden even presents the idea that the unions are using their power, you know, their political power, going to politicians and trying to prevent the approval of new charter schools. And they've made, we're going to play a clip, but they've made vouchers this evil word, even though people don't even really know what vouchers are or what vouchers do. It's just, you know, I mean, these are the educators. So they know people don't really, most people anyway, don't think beyond buzzwords. And they've done a pretty good job of making vouchers seem like a bad thing. I have to say, I stand corrected, at least in the case of New Jersey, that, you know, vouchers, I don't think I ever made it sound like vouchers are an evil plot initiated by the unions themselves. But if that was the situation, the unions would step in and try to take advantage of that. I still believe that. In the short term, I don't think vouchers would really be the worst thing, because I had no idea. I have no experience being a parent in Newark or being a middle school or high school student in one of these horrific schools and having an opportunity to get out and go someplace better. And that's all done by a lottery process. All these people go and they sit in this room and they have numbers and they call out numbers lottery style to see who gets these vouchers. And in the film, you know, I'm not real big into the whole Michael Moore, let's find somebody having a hard time and put a camera in their face and then we'll use their emotion to distract you from thinking logically about this issue so you'll arrive at my point of view. That's something you have to be careful about when you're making documentaries, I think. Michael Moore, of course, not careful about that at all. If, you know, if he didn't do that, his documentaries would all be like 15 minutes each. Maybe I'm a sucker, because I watched these kids at this lottery not hearing their number called. And the other movie, education documentary, Waiting for Superman, deals with this as well. These kids and these parents are incredibly distressed over the fact that they have to continue in these schools. And I think I kind of got to this position of, you know, looking at the situation from the top down, exactly not the kind of thinking I like to do, and saying, well, this won't work, and this is what will happen, and just, you know, completely overlooking the human side of it and the urgency that a lot of these parents and students feel because of their horrible situations that they're forced into every day. But like I said, maybe I'm just a sucker. But you know who's not a sucker? Joyce Powell, the president of the NJEA. She sees right through this whole ruse of vouchers and charter schools. Here's a clip from the film.
Ninth in the waiting list, Ariel Montesino. 168, 40th on the waiting list, Timothy Tollifer. One 169, 41st on the waiting list, Alaysia Pace.
Have you been to a charter school lottery or seen video of these things? Because I have, and there are examples where you see parents crying with tears of joy because their kids are getting out of the district schools. But what's wrong with the picture that the schools that spend oftentimes so much more money are the ones that the parents are crying to get out of?
Well, I've not been to a charter school lottery. I have been to several charter schools and have observed what's going on in those schools. And charter schools, really, in New Jersey, were designed to be innovative programs. So I could imagine that if a parent wanted their child to be involved in an innovative program and an experimental program, that they would be extremely pleased if their child were selected. Parents are generally forced to be volunteers in the school, so you have a better connection with the community and the parent if that's part of the deal, that my child goes here, but I have to. Well, in several that I've observed, parents are required to attend certain daytime activities and evening activities.
So the teachers' union says it's not a fair fight because charters are allowed to compel parental involvement and the district schools can't. There's just one problem. It's wrong.
Charter schools cannot require parents to participate in their activities or events in any kind of way, and they cannot penalize parents for choosing not to cooperate with the school's expectations around parental involvement.
I happen to be very familiar with the political environment in New Jersey where the original charter law was written. There was huge controversy. The New Jersey Education Association vigorously opposed all of this. Some people suggested that there might be more than one authorizer, like social service agencies or like Rutgers. In many states, universities are allowed to sponsor schools. Michigan, Minnesota, some other states, universities are allowed to sponsor this. But there was vigorous political opposition in New Jersey to the whole idea. And so the ultimate compromise was, okay, we'll only have one organization, which is the State Department of Education. When power is concentrated in one place, there's almost always a problem.
And of course, homeschooling for most of these people where they're showing in these inner city areas, a lot of single parents, one income families, if that, homeschooling might not be an option. Certainly, most parents don't feel like they have the abilities or the resources to homeschool their children because you need a master's degree and you need $18,000 a year, according to the public school system. So my whole thinking was like, boy, maybe vouchers aren't the worst thing in the short term. Are they going to fix anything really? No, but we're not trying to fix something. And neither are the politicians. Like it must be so frustrating to look at any complex issue in our society from a non-voluntarist point of view. It must just be so confusing and excruciating because in the film, Bowden, who seems to me to be more of a conservative, is like talking about a problem that needs to be solved. There is no problem. This is a system that works for all the people who have the power to change a system like the government education. Those people are already all set. You know, I think that there's a lot of politicians, especially lately, the governor in New Jersey, for example, Chris Christie, has talked a lot about the problem of the unions, but he's a Republican and he knows that those are votes that go to Democrats. And the same thing with Scott Walker in Wisconsin, the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. They're trying to basically decapitate Democratic fundraising by taking power away from these unions. I don't see any indication that it's really about helping kids. You know, politics is not about helping people. And that's why when you're looking at it from some other point of view, like Republican or Democrat or independent or political whatever, it must be really frustrating. Why does it look like nobody's trying to help? Because they're not. Because the worst types of people gravitate to this power and then they use it to get what they want at everybody's expense. So for all the people who could affect change in a positive way in government education, for them, there is no problem. There is no problem. There's no problems in government. It is doing exactly what it is supposed to do. It makes the use of force look legitimate. Then the worst kinds of people gravitate to that apparently legitimate use of force. And the government redistributes resources to them while just sprinkling down enough to prevent a total insurrection. You can go back to Egypt. That's what government does. The sprinkling down, the pittance in forms of welfare and Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, that's all relatively new. That idea is not new, but bread and circuses was not going to work forever. I mean, bread, come on. Circus. I think most of us remember the outrage over the TARP bailouts. $700 billion. Wait, was it $700 billion? Yeah, $700 billion to these irresponsible banks. Well, it was recently revealed through a Bloomberg investigation and study. And by Bloomberg, I don't mean New York City's live-in nanny. I mean the news organization that bears his name, that along with that $700 billion, there was also secretly loaned to these banks at 0% interest, $7.7 trillion. Then the government borrowed the money back from the banks at interest. $7.7 trillion stolen from future taxpayers, given to banks, and then borrowed back at interest. I mean, the history of government is plunder, appropriate, plunder, appropriate, plunder, appropriate. It's not for you. It's not for me. It's not for the children. It's not for blah, blah, blah. That's what government does. So it would be very frustrating, I think, and I remember this. I remember being like this, to have this fantasy that the government is there to solve problems. And the rhetoric can be great. Chris Christie, very entertaining guy, the governor of New Jersey. He has really ripped into these unions. And whatever his motives are, I mean, I shouldn't automatically assume that I shouldn't be such a cynic, maybe. I mean, maybe Christie really does care about the state of education. And even if just for his legacy, he would like to see some of this corruption in that bureaucracy go away. His talking points are great. And his digs on these unions are great and very accurate. But so many libertarians are having these efficiency-based arguments of government can't solve problems. I'm guilty of this myself. They're not trying to solve problems, because the things that are problems for people like you and me, and people even less fortunate, maybe, people who live in these inner cities, the things that are so problematic, on the other side of that, it's advantageous for the people who are connected to government. Just about every government bureaucracy that exists today was set up to solve, originally, some kind of problem or perceived problem. And this, of course, is why in past shows I've warned against the concept of pragmatism, of being pragmatic. You know, when you talk to college kids or political people, like college kids who are studying political science or something, they're very pragmatic. Like, here's what works. Okay. Well, who defines the problems? And that's a real concern in a hierarchical system like ours, where so much of public thought and perception is controlled. Who gets to say, okay, here's a problem? I mean, you already know the answer, right? Not good people decide, here's a problem, and we need to be pragmatic about the solution. Sure, we might get a little bit of blood on our hands, but we're solving a problem. And we've seen plenty of that over the last 10 years. You know, what's happened in the Middle East, what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not new. I mean, Horace Mann, you know, 150 years ago, saw a problem of, you know, these devilish ideas penetrating America. And that's you need to have some kind of an intervention. You need to have some kind of a bureaucracy set up to counter that. Look where we are today with school. But I mean, you just think about it for a second. Like, a bureaucracy, some, you know, the resulting from some initiative or project or program is set up. They have to hire people. Right? Now, maybe in the beginning it goes well, the people work hard, they're motivated, but over time, you know, after they realize there are no market signals, there is no persistent consumer demand or feedback, those kinds of people tend to get lazy, they tend to get unionized, and then they enjoy, as far as working conditions are concerned, a level of pay and benefits and leisure that they could never find in the private sector. Are they really going to go out and work to solve the problem? The problem that justifies the existence of their job? In many cases, and education is one of them, these people can't even be fired. They can't even be fired. This is one of the issues that's addressed in the film The Cartel. He takes the statistics to the president of the union, Joyce Powell. Because unions insist that bad teachers can be removed. Well, the statistic is 0.03%. 0.03% lost their jobs. When Bowden asked her this question,
can it be true that no more than 0.03% of tenured teachers are unfit to teach school? In other words, 99.97% are doing a good job.
Her response, it's really amazing.
Barringer High School, you were principal. What percentage of the teachers were underperforming and should have been replaced?
About 30%, 30, 40%.
But let's get something straight. Even if Hector Bonilla is right and up to 40% of Barringer High School teachers should be replaced, that would still leave 60% that are doing the job. And some of them are probably excellent teachers. In fact, some of them may be watching this documentary. So let's be perfectly clear. Those good teachers deserve our respect. Wanting lousy teachers out of the classroom doesn't mean you're against all teachers. A point so obvious, I can hardly believe it needs to be made. But this absurd idea that you've got to support every teacher, or else you hate all teachers, has been an effective myth put forward by the union for years.
How many tenured teachers are let go? Isn't it less than 0.1%?
Well, I don't know the statistic, but I will tell you that we have very few tenure hearings in New Jersey.
Can it be true that no more than 0.03% of tenured teachers are unfit to teach school? In other words, 99.97% are doing a good job.
I think 99.97 success rate should be celebrated. That's something that we should be saying, wow, that's a pretty good success rate.
Now, that's amazing. If the whole movie was made up of just that question and that answer, I would have been just as satisfied. And nothing against Bowden at all. The film, as far as learning about these unions is concerned, would have been just as educational, in my opinion. But it continues.
That's a pretty good success rate if we're looking at what we're really providing in terms of education for students. I would imagine that you hope that when you go to the physician that you go to, that 99.97% of them are successful.
But bad doctors can have their licenses revoked, bad lawyers disbarred, bad teachers, even the 0.03% that are fired, imagine how bad you've got to be, have no license revoked. They can usually just move on to another district because their records are sealed, a policy Ms. Powell defends.
The teacher allegedly followed the student out of the class and told her, quote, I'm going to kick your ass, bitch, unquote, before punching the student in the chest. The teacher also reportedly slapped a student in the face. The teacher was not fired. The union negotiated that in exchange for quitting, she was given 9 months of pay plus money for each unused vacation and sick days. The district promised not to tell any future employers of hers why she left. When the union fights for bad teachers, as this anecdote seems to imply, isn't that bad for good teachers?
I would say that the union ensures that an individual has due process, and so that whatever mechanism that we have to put in place to ensure that that person is treated fairly, that that person has the ability to defend themselves, and frankly, that is an unacceptable situation. The other thing that I will say is that, you know, people make mistakes. We all are not perfect. And so when a person makes a mistake, should they be barred from ever being able to be employed again? Should their entire life be ruined because they've made a mistake?
Try as she might, it's hard for Powell or anyone else to deny that tenure has protected the jobs of some very incompetent teachers, like this one from California.
But get this, a man taught English and social studies for 17 years, hiding one thing. He was illiterate.
I feel like, for the most part, this is kind of review, huh? But what I'm getting at is that I was making some very, I guess, more pragmatic arguments about vouchers, and, you know, now kind of seeing the human side, seeing the urgency. I'm not thinking that they're going to solve a problem, but man, if it helps some of these poor kids and these poor parents in these terrible places, in these horrific schools, get out of that situation in the short term. Well, I guess I'm just saying that I'm not going to go out of my way to speak out against it. And of course, it's a difficult thing for me to say, because with vouchers, every major foundational problem in the government education racket continues. Like, yeah, we're still going to steal money from people in the form of property tax, but now distributing it in a more fair and equitable way where there's choice, so now it's okay, right? Because we insert this free market illusion in front of plunder. So, I'm kind of talking myself out of this, which I don't want to do. What I'm saying is, I would have, after seeing this film and thinking about this a little bit more carefully and weighing it against my own experience, having worked not in these environments, but with kids who came out of these environments, I would have a real hard time, you know, going and standing outside one of these voucher lotteries and saying to a parent, while they're experiencing this great feeling of joy and relief, and say, well, you shouldn't be able to have that because it perpetuates the problem. It's just masking the problem. The problem's going to continue either way. I don't think that these people in New Jersey and elsewhere should have to suffer because of it, and there should be no recourse for them. And in the future, I hope I can be more thoughtful and compassionate when talking about vouchers. And maybe not being so immediately dismissive. And from my point of view, maybe this serves no other purpose than just having more constructive dialogue with other people. This is a pretty pervasive perception of libertarian ideas that, oh, well, you guys just say no to everything. You just think everything is a bad idea. Well, if we're talking about government, I mean, yeah, we're just consistent. Like, yeah, if it's a violation of property rights, if it's a violation of self-ownership, if it's a violation of the NAP, it's bad. Everything that the government does requires that 1-2-3 punch. So it's not like the left and the right, who seem to choose their ethics the way people choose items out of a buffet. We're just consistent. But just being immediately dismissive and then being kind of a dick about why you're so dismissive without even asking the other person why they believe that or how they arrived at that conclusion, it's not a good communication strategy. I'm learning. And there's plenty of opponents to vouchers already. And from what I saw in this film, that is not exactly what I would consider good company.
The unions, though, have made voucher such a dirty word that it's funny. If you just call it scholarships for all, suddenly support goes up.
You can walk up to a parent in Newark and say, if I was the state and I gave you some money so you could send your kid to private school, would you want to do that? They'd be like, hell yeah. And then you're like, well, you know, that's a voucher. They'd be like, I'm not for that.
How do you feel about vouchers, private school vouchers?
You know, I hear a lot of bad things about it, and I really can't comment either way because you hear that it's taking money from the schools and providing it for whatever. But it makes sense to me.
If you were to announce that on Monday you were giving out scholarships to private schools to the first come, I guarantee you beginning Sunday night there would be parents lining up to get those scholarships on Monday morning.
Reverend Jackson advocated for vouchers at a debate held by the East Camden County NAACP.
After year after year of failed promises, I decided that the best way for African-American and low-income children to get a quality education is through school choice. A quality education should not be a privilege and should not be based on zip code or income. It is a civil right.
Now, we can romanticize vouchers.
His debate opponent, Walter Farrell, begins by quoting the late economist Milton Friedman.
It is essential that no conditions be attached to the acceptance of vouchers, because we don't want it to interfere with the freedom of private enterprise to experiment. This is about money. And we had an experiment in our history. It was called the Tuskegee experiment. It went on for 30 years where they denied African-American males treatment for syphilis, gave them placebos knowing that they had syphilis.
That's right, because Milton Friedman used the word experiment in a sentence describing vouchers in the 1950s. To Mr. Farrell, that makes this school choice policy comparable to letting black people die from syphilis, like in the Tuskegee experiment. He then selects three pictures of white people who support vouchers.
For yearly accountability. First, our president, John Walton, Michael Joyce.
And then tells us.
And you notice here, you have seen a single black face as a promoter or a single brown face of this initiative.
And then the one black face he does show us is of a guy we supposedly can't trust because he owns too many cars.
Two Rolls Royce, two Mercedes Benz, one Bentley, one Hummer H2, one Maybach. He's rolling like Mr. Big.
If school vouchers really are an evil white plot to hurt black people like in the Tuskegee experiment, then I guess you could say in finding a spokesman like Reverend Reginald Jackson, the racists have gone extremely undercover.
Now, of course, it's worth pointing out that the entire voucher debate occludes any discussion about the legitimacy of positive rights and rights at somebody else's expense. It's assumed on both sides that public education is a right. There's no debate about that at all. It's just a matter of we're going to take the money at other people's expense, and then just, you know, the process of how we distribute that money is what's up for debate. That certainly is a problem. It is a problem, however, that I find preferable to the problem of the systematic trapping, abusing, and terrorizing of children without an ounce of hope and without any possibility of escape. I hate to say it, but this is one of those cases where the enemy of my enemy is my friend. At least in the state of New Jersey, from what I saw in this film. And this system that makes it possible is going to be there tomorrow, a week from now, a year from now, most likely, unfortunately, 5 years from now. Regardless of what you and I oppose today and why. So, a little bit of hope in a totally tragic and desperate situation for a lot of these families. It's hard for me to really rail against that. So, if there are disagreements, the best place maybe to express them in the short term would be the School Sucks Facebook page. I look forward to seeing what people have to say. That's it for today. Thank you very much for listening, and take care.